Today is Wednesday, May 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
They could buy from someplace else other than China?
That's President Trump on U.S.-China trade. Also ahead, the U.S. ordered its non-emergency employees to leave Iraq today, and Sudan's protest leaders and the Transitional Military Council say they agree on the main structure of a transitional government. It's all on today's International Edition. The United States today ordered its non-emergency employees to leave Iraq, a move that comes as the Trump administration warns of potential threats against American forces in the Middle East from Iran or Iranian-backed proxies. A statement posted by the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad said the order applied both to staff there and at the U.S. consulate in Erbil. U.S. embassies in Iraq, Lebanon, the United Arab Emirates, and Turkmenistan all warned American citizens to maintain a high level of vigilance. Well, for more on these latest developments, joining us live here in the studio is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me in the studio today.
Yes. Now, are tensions continuing to rise in Iran?
What we're seeing is, yes, they are continuing to rise. Let me just tell you about what I've heard the threat entail. So, according to U.S. officials, part of the threat, at least, is the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran had been putting missiles, ballistic missiles, onto some boats. And the thought was that they were going to target American troops. That's what we're hearing at the Pentagon. We are waiting for more. We go, well, show me what you're talking about. And they have yet to provide us some evidence for this threat, but we are pursuing that every day. But at the Pentagon, people are on high alert. Everyone that I speak to seems to think that the threat is credible, it is real, and there are several planning operations going on, planning everything from what you heard in the New York Times report of tens of thousands of troops preparing to go to the Middle East to something smaller on how do you respond to potential sabotage like we've seen happening with the UAE.
Also, what are other countries saying about this situation?
Well, I mean, it depends on the countries. Germany, for example, has been scaling back operations in Iraq. If you read between the lines there, it looks like they've seen the United States intelligence. They don't have intelligence of their own, but they're following based on United States intelligence. Then you look at what Spain has done. The U.S. sent a carrier strike group, the USS Abraham Lincoln. That carrier strike group also included a Spanish frigate. But Spain announced that they are pulling out their Spanish frigate because the Spanish frigate was just going to be training with the carrier strike group, and with the potential thought of a conflict but with Iran, they don't want any part of that.
Interesting. And also, President Trump, he is rejecting the notion of that he is sending 120,000 troops to the Middle East, to that region. So why, where did this come from that he was going to do this?
Well, it's interesting because after he rejected it, he said, if I were to send troops, I would send a lot more. So it's where the New York Times says it's getting its reporting is from officials who had planned out different options. It's quite possible the president had not seen these options. That's completely a possibility. And it's very possible that that option will never happen as well. But the Pentagon prepares for everything. I can't stress that enough. But there are already a lot of United States troops around Iran. If you think about all the bases that it has across the Middle East and all the power that it has in the seas, there are anywhere between 60,000 and 80,000 sailors, airmen, marines, and soldiers that we have surrounding Iran.
Also, are you hearing anything on the other side? Like, what is Iran saying about this? Are you getting anything?
Well, Iran is stressing that this is the United States escalating tensions. I think they tried to say it was fake intelligence or something similar to the rhetoric that President Trump would use. But other than that, they're remaining quiet, and the United States is steadily building up its presence there. No actions. Let's be very clear. The United States hasn't targeted Iran in any way, but I think that the military is preparing itself should the need for options occur.
Okay, interesting developments. Thank you so much. That's VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump is denying trade talks with China have collapsed and is characterizing what many are calling a trade war between the world's two largest economies as a little squabble. We have a dialogue going. It's always going to continue, Trump said in response to a question yesterday from VOA on the White House lawn. We had a deal that was very close and they broke it. As a result, administration officials say the president this week decided to deepen what they bluntly characterize as a trade war with China at a time when political division in Washington is as wide as any time in recent memory. There is a surprisingly high degree of bipartisan unity confronting Beijing. Associated Press reporter Sagar Magani has more.
His administration's looking at jacking up tariffs on nearly all imports from China, from pacifiers to tuna. He says businesses can avoid the boost.
They could buy from someplace else other than China.
Manufacturers might be able to do that, but Brett Davis says it's not that easy for fellow farmers.
We have spent 40 years making a trade partner with China.
Davis grows soybeans, wheat, and corn in Ohio. Losing China as a customer would be rough.
That's very scary for us as the American farmer.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
Among the top stories in the world, the Taliban captures a district center today in southern Afghanistan, killing at least 13 government soldiers. U.S. President Donald Trump says he did not order Attorney General William Barr to launch another investigation into the origin of the Mueller probe, but he says he's glad Barr did. And the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee agrees with President Trump's son for him to appear for a closed-door interview in June. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have recently been able to gain some insight into the creation of Neptune's tiniest moon, Hipparchus, thanks to observations made with the NASA ESA Hubble Space Telescope. Hipparchus, which has a diameter of only 34 kilometers, was discovered in 2013 after scientists analyzed Hubble-captured images of Neptune. The scientists theorize that Hipparchus is actually a fragment of a close neighboring moon, Proteus, after a comet impacted it billions of years ago. Photos taken in 1989 by NASA's Voyager 2 spacecraft show a huge impact crater on Proteus that scientists say is large enough that could have caused the moon to shatter. The tiny moon orbits Neptune at a distance of about 105,000 kilometers and is within only 12,000 kilometers of Proteus. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The ongoing trade dispute between the United States and China is having an impact on farmers across the U.S. Their corn and soybean crops are subject to tariffs in China and increasing competition from other suppliers. As VOA's Kane Faribault reports, U.S. farmers aren't just concerned about their bottom lines this year. They're also worried about the long-term consequences of a trade war on the only business many have ever known.
Life on a farm is filled with routine. For Pam Johnson of Floyd, Iowa, hers is now weighed down by tariffs.
First thing I do is make a pot of coffee, go to the computer and look at what grain prices have done overnight, and usually do a gut clutch because they've been going down. They're at 5 months lows.
Johnson and her husband are proud sixth generation farmers. And like many farmers, they're going through some of the harshest economic conditions of their lives.
We're all tightening our belts.
U.S. farmers are facing a potential sixth consecutive year of declining farm income. Prices for corn and soybeans are down, while the cost of producing them is up. With uncertainty over congressional support for a new trade agreement with Canada and Mexico, and the impact of China's retaliatory tariffs on U.S. grain, short-term concern over U.S. trade policy is turning into long-term fear.
Because we hear it may be out to 2025 before we see some of those markets come back to us, if they ever do. What is the damage being done that's irreparable?
Damage her son Ben Johnson may have to deal with when he takes over the family business.
All farms are going to suffer because of this. There's a difference between making it and flourishing.
The Johnsons feel there is a growing disconnect between farmers and the rest of the American workforce. Fueled by politicians increasingly hostile to trade policies the agricultural industry depends on.
I think we need as much trade as we can and to be openly trading with as many places as we can. I mean, it's no different than any business. You want as many customers as you can.
I was really disheartened that trade really has become a dirty word in both parties.
Pam Johnson says she didn't vote for President Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential election based on his trade positions. Nothing since has eased her concerns.
Saying that I'm a tariff man and that trade wars are easy to win concerns me. There's still a lot of farmers who still support President Trump. I think there are more seeds of doubt being planted as we look forward into 2019 and no resolution, and the light at the end of the tunnel seems to be getting dimmer about getting these things done.
Politics aside, Johnson admits success for her family business is closely tied to successful U.S. trade policy.
I don't want to see President Trump fail. We all need him to make this work and to make it so that all of us win.
A win, her son says, can't come soon enough.
Honestly, we've kind of already missed the peak soybean export season, so in a way it's already too late. I guess it's never too late, but before now would have been great.
While negotiations continue, the Trump administration says it is actively working on a new financial assistance program to help farmers weather the continuing trade storm. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Floyd, Iowa.
A grieving France paid its respects yesterday to two commandos killed during a raid to rescue four hostages in the Sahel region of Africa last week, under the shadow of a row over risks taken by two of those freed. French Special Forces Cedric de Pierrepont, 33, and Alain Bertocello, 28, who died in the operation in Burkina Faso, were honored with a ceremony at the Invalides military complex in Paris, led by President Emmanuel Macron. The French hostages were kidnapped on May 1st while on a safari trip in Benin's Pinjarre National Park. The tourist local guide was found dead on May 4th. Accompanying the outpouring of grief in France over the two young soldiers' deaths has been anger over the French tourist's decision to visit an area subject to a foreign ministry travel warning. This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Coming up this Sunday, Mother's Day special. Yeah, 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 mama. Whoa. 55 minutes of your favorite African songs that speak to, for, and about your mamas. Or about you, mamas. Now, one mother and diva of Malian music, Oumou Sangaré, speaks to us from Wassaloum country about her music festival there, and Song of the Week features Akodi and her song, Shengerera Mama. I'm sorry, Mama Yangu. So tune in and feel the love. Music Time in Africa, 1505 and 20500 Universal Time.
Sudan's protest leaders and the Transitional Military Council late yesterday said they have agreed on the main structure of a transitional government, the most significant step forward in the weeks-long standoff between the two sides. But which side, civilians or the military, will have a majority in a new transitional ruling council until elections in 2022 is still in dispute. Naba Mohideen reports from Khartoum.
Protesters on Monday said troops tried to clear their ongoing sit-in outside army headquarters in Khartoum. But the protesters, who have camped out since the military announced the removal of longtime President Omar al-Bashir last Thursday, refused to move. The protesters are demanding a quicker move to civilian rule in Sudan than the military's announced 2-year transition to an elected government. Many like Ala Salah are skeptical that the military will hand over power. She said that when Bashir's regime came to power, it was under similar circumstances. They gave promises that they didn't fulfill, says Salah. We need proof, not only talks, she says, and we are staying until our demands are fulfilled. The military's transitional leadership has changed twice since it said Bashir had been placed under house arrest following 4 months of popular demonstrations. The military council on Monday appointed Hashim Abdalmutallib as army chief of staff and said the move was aimed at changing the military. Hashim was appointed by Bashir in February as vice chief of army staff. Some protesters and analysts have questioned whether the military is being truthful when it says Bashir was doubled and arrested. But others, like political analyst Mutasim Ahmed, say the coup was real. He says trust in the military has won over trust in politics inside the army forces. The military has considered the situation, says Ahmed, and that's what led to the big sit-in and the success of it. The military council now in charge said Bashir had ordered troops to disperse the sit-in at whatever cost, but the military refused. The protests were triggered in December by food and fuel shortages that saw the price of bread skyrocket. When security forces tried to disperse the protest at army headquarters, troops blocked them, an event that signaled Bashir had lost military support. But protesters remained unconvinced that the military is fully on their side. Monday, the main protest organizers, the Sudanese Professionals Association, called for more people to join the demonstrations and the demands for civilian rule. Naba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Here in the U.S., more than a dozen people are making initial appearances in a U.S. federal court in the southern state of Texas this week in connection with what prosecutors are calling a large-scale marriage fraud scheme that sought to use fake marriages as a way to gain permanent residency status in the United States. So far, U.S. authorities have arrested 50 of the nearly 100 people charged with crimes that include marriage fraud, mail fraud, immigration fraud, lying under oath, and witness tampering. The first trials are scheduled to begin in late June. Well, business practices that respect the earth, protect human rights, promote fair labor, and fight corruption aren't just good for people and the environment. They're also excellent for a company's profitability. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Leah Kingo, the UN Global Compact's CEO and executive director, and the keynote speaker at a sustainability and innovation conference sponsored by the French American Chamber of Commerce in New York.
Companies are understanding more and more clearly that being a responsible business is part of doing business today. Employees are requesting this. The financial sector is requesting that companies have an approach to environment, to human rights, to labor, to anti-corruption. And we are seeing companies like BlackRock, for example, beginning to evaluate companies for their sustainability through the 10 principles of the Global Compact.
Help me to understand why companies might think it's in their best interest to be sustainable.
It's clear from our companies that they are performing better from a financial perspective. Their share price is outperforming the share price of companies that are not taking an ethical, social, responsible perspective. So they're very, very clear arguments.
I understand why holding these values might make them more attractive to certain investors and shareholders, but how do sustainable practices themselves make businesses more profitable?
I think it's at least three different things. It's an excellent way of managing risks, and it's also an excellent way of optimizing opportunities. For example, many companies looking at the 17 goals see that climate change, gender equality are themes that are crucial for future markets and for the world. They build into the business how to save energy. They make programs for how to put women on their top leadership programs. And both these things we can document is contributing to making a stronger financial bottom line. The third perspective is that running a business in a responsible way require that you are in close contact with all your stakeholders, not only with the regulators and with your shareholders, with customers, with prospective employees, with journalists. It's actually a very healthy and productive way of running a business.
Does this strategy only work for multinational corporations, or does it work for small companies and grassroots businesses?
Of course, the efforts can be scaled in different ways, but the thinking that the company must be a force for good, that's the same kind of thinking. Lately, I was in both Tanzania and Kenya, and I saw so many examples of great companies, both large and small, that are really picking up this agenda. And it's interesting because worldwide, 80% of our companies have picked up the goals, but in Africa, it's actually 85%. So I felt so inspired by the innovative spirit that the African companies have and the way they incorporate some of the social problems in Africa into their business strategies in a very natural way that we could learn a lot from in the northern part of the world.
Could you expand on that thought a little bit?
I see in many other countries that some people are expecting the government or the authorities to take care of social problems. That's not so much the case in many African countries. I mean, there everybody come together to deal with the challenges that are there, to think about what is it they can do to contribute to creating a more sustainable world, to the benefit of all of us as humans, but also to business and governments.
That was Leah Kingo, CEO and Executive Director of the UN Global. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Well, Catholic clerics in four northern European countries have taken the unprecedented step of urging their congregations to back pro-European Union parties in continent-wide elections later this month. The Catholic bishops from France, Germany, Belgium, and Luxembourg have put themselves squarely in opposition to nationalist populists. Praising the principle of solidarity and collaboration among nations, they warn that the EU is under threat. The bishops urged Europeans to vote in the May 23rd to 26th elections for the 751-seat EU Parliament in a show of support for European unity and to promote dialogue and integration between peoples. Analysts say this month's election is possibly the most consequential since 1979, when Europeans first began casting ballots for a European Parliament. The continent's new breed of nationalist populist is eschewing pocketbook issues in campaigning and focusing on issues of national identity. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Rob McLean. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter following VOA News, either on the radio or online at voanews.com/encounter. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to encounter@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/encounter. Carol Castiel VOA or on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.